Chapter 3. This changes everything. The aftermath of 9/11. On the bright blue morning of September 11, 2001, Colonel Paul Hughes was in his office in the Pentagon's D-ring in Army staff space. It was 9:37 a.m. when the room exploded. Plaques and a clock shot off the walls. The bookshelves pitched forward. Hughes looked out the window and saw above the Pentagon's roof a huge fireball. "I am going to die today," he thought. He looked around and wondered why everyone and everything was silent, not realizing that the explosion of American Airlines Flight 77 hitting underneath his office at 530 miles per hour had temporarily robbed him of much of his hearing. He and his co-workers made their way through the acrid smoke to the Pentagon's courtyard, a football field of space with a hot dog stand in the middle. Security officers announced that a fourth plane was heading toward Washington, so the crowd moved out to the Pentagon's sprawling south parking lot. After waiting a while, he realized that it would be a long time before he got back into his office. So, without briefcase or Army beret, he walked the 4 miles to his sister's house in Alexandria. As he did, he dwelled on another American defeat. "I thought to myself, this is what a Union officer must have felt like in July of 1861, walking back from Bull Run, the first big battle of the Civil War, which ended with Federal troops streaming back 25 miles to Washington. His bottom line on the day? We got our ass kicked." So began a path that 2 years later would have Colonel Hughes working on the strategy of the U.S. occupation in Iraq and then moving into opposition to U.S. policy there. The explosion at the Pentagon of Flight 77 and the day's 3 other hijack attacks provided the political opening that Paul Wolfowitz, Richard Perle, and others needed. Perle and Wolfowitz quickly began to make the case that 9/11 was precipitated by a myopic and false realism that wrongly had sought accommodation with evil. The idea that we could live with another 20 years of stagnation in the Middle East that breeds this radicalism and breeds terrorism is, I think, just unacceptable, especially after September 11th, Wolfowitz later told the Jerusalem Post. In a talk in New York, he added, "We cannot go back to business as usual. We cannot think that this problem of Islamic extremist-based terrorism is going to leave us alone." 4 days after the attacks, the president and his national security team met at Camp David to discuss the response to 9/11. The briefing materials that Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz brought offered 3 targets in the war on terrorism: Al-Qaeda, Afghanistan's Taliban, and Iraq. But only Wolfowitz pressed the case that day for attacking Iraq. Wolfowitz's advocacy of attacking Iraq in response to 9/11 stemmed from the same views that later led him to underestimate the strength of the Iraqi insurgency, said a person who reviewed those Pentagon briefing materials. "In both cases, you have this know-it-all who won't believe the intelligence community and won't believe that non-state actors can do this much damage," he observed. Yet this person came away, as many critics do, finding himself oddly sympathetic to Wolfowitz. "There are 2 types of villains in Washington, hacks and fools," he concluded. "He isn't a hack. He's deeply misguided. He's impervious to evidence. And he's a serious, thoughtful guy." On September 20, Ahmed Chalabi went to the Pentagon to speak to the Defense Policy Board, an advisory group headed by Richard Perle. The first speaker at the meeting in Rumsfeld's conference room was Bernard Lewis, a historian of the Middle East whose pessimistic writings on Islam and terrorism had grown deeply influential within the Bush administration. The second speaker was Chalabi, an Iraqi exile leader. It was around this time, a senior military intelligence official recalled, that Perle's old subordinate Douglas Feith, who had become the Pentagon policy chief, put out the word to his aides to focus on Iraq.